This is Audible.
The Gender Game, written by Bella Forrest. Narrated by Rebecca Soler and Zachary Weber.
Prologue. My sweating palms slipped against the handles of my bike as I cycled at a pace I hoped would not look suspicious. I tried to fix my eyes ahead on the perfectly even road and not keep glancing over my shoulder at the makeshift wooden trailer I was pulling behind me. As the uniformed townhouses on either side of me grew sparse, so did the light. By the time I arrived at the edge of town, the sun had set. I had been lucky so far. I hadn't passed anybody I knew, and nobody had halted me to ask where I was going. I slowed to a stop once I reached the end of the last concrete road on this side of the city. Catching my breath, I wiped my palms against my blouse. My lower back felt sticky with sweat, and I had run out of water. But I was almost there now. I repositioned my throbbing palms on the handlebars and my feet on the pedals of the bike when a voice called behind me. "Violet? Is that you?" I froze. I knew that voice. It was one I'd grown accustomed to hearing every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Ms. Dale, my defense trainer. What was she doing in this part of town at nightfall? I forced a casual expression to my face and twisted around. The fluorescent street lamps illuminated the tall, lithe brunette standing on the sidewalk outside Georgette's laundry. She was clutching a bundle of white sheets. "Good evening, Ms. Dale," I called back. "What are you doing out here, Violet?" she asked. My jaw twitched as she left the sidewalk and approached me. "Trashing Ms. Connolly's old china?" I explained, a response I had thought up long before leaving my room this morning. "Oh, I see," she said, her eyes moving from my three-wheeled trailer and returning to my face. "Wish I had someone to run my errands," she grimaced at her laundry. I managed a half-smile. She lingered a few seconds longer before glancing back at the laundrette. "Right. Well, you'd better be on your way. You know the junkyard gets creepier the later it gets." "Yeah," I murmured. "See you Monday." She turned on her heel, and I let out a slow breath. Gritting my teeth, I faced forward again, my eyes focusing on the narrow cobblestone path that branched off from the end of the road. I cycled for another 15 minutes down the winding route, past the suburban cottages and misted greenhouses, until I reached a pair of corrugated iron gates, the junkyard's entrance. Pulling the gates open just wide enough for my bike to fit through, I rolled it inside. I gazed around the sea of color-coded trash containers, wide-eyed. Nobody was around. So far, so good. The overpowering smell of artificial mint filled my nostrils as I wound around the containers toward the back of the enclosure. The chemical the hygiene department sprayed in here helped to mask the odor of trash, but had the tendency to cause a dull headache. Arriving at the last row of trash containers lining the back wall, I stopped. I grabbed the handles of the container directly in front of me and slowly eased it forward to reveal the brickwork behind it. I hurried to the wall and sank to my knees on the ground. My fingers fumbled along the bricks, feeling for the telltale gap. Finding it, I gained a firmer grip and coaxed it out of place. Then I worked on the previously weakened bricks behind it and above it, until I had created a hole just large enough for my frame to squeeze through. I had to be quick now, quicker than ever. If someone spotted me here like this, all my days of preparation, all my sleepless nights, would be in vain. I darted for the wooden trailer hooked to the back of my bike and, clutching the clasp that was holding the lid securely shut, I unfastened it. My heart was hammering against my chest as I opened it. Curled up in the cramped wooden crate knees drawn to his chest, eyes tightly closed, was my 8-year-old brother, Timothy. My eyes moved over the mark etched into his right hand, the mark of a black crescent. The mark that had changed our lives forever. It took a few seconds for him to unglue his eyelids and realize that it was finally time to climb out. His black hair clung to his moist forehead as he raised his head to look at me. His gray eyes shone with fear. I leaned over and wrapped my arms around his midriff, helping him step out. He winced and groaned against me. It killed me to think of how much time he'd been holed up in that box. But it wouldn't be long now. It wouldn't be long. "Come on, buddy," I breathed. "Cad will already be waiting for us." I pointed to the dark gap in the wall. He glanced at me uncertainly before lowering to his hands and knees. He scurried through. I followed immediately behind him. A chill stole through me as we emerged on the other side. I swallowed hard as I gazed around at the self-frequented surroundings. At least, what I could see of them. We were standing amid a slushy marshland, pale and glistening beneath the strip lights that lined the exterior of the wall. 15 feet away flowed Vale River, above which hung a dense gray mist. The river was wide, so wide that the opposite bank was a blur even in the daytime when the mist was thinner. We crept as quietly as we could through the sludge toward the edge of the vaporous water. I continued to reassure Tim in whispers that Cad would be waiting in his rowboat, just like he'd promised. Only a little further up. But as we reached the river's border, neither Cad nor his boat were anywhere to be seen. "Where is he?" Tim gasped. He's got to be along here somewhere. Let's move up the bank a bit more." I led Tim further up the river through the marsh, knowing how much danger we were in now. My whole plan had revolved around Cad being here, waiting for us, so that Tim could immediately board his boat. We shouldn't be roaming in the open like this. Wardens could spot us at any second, and the consequences would be catastrophic. "Oh!" Tim hissed, making me jump. "There's a boat!" He jabbed a finger toward the river as Cad's competitive rowboat came into view. Warm relief washed over me. Thank God. Cad closed the distance between us, an apologetic look on his unshaven face. "I'm so sorry," he whispered as he bumped the boat against the bank. "I had some, unexpected complications. You know, with Margot. She started asking me where I was going, and... let's just get this done." I turned to my brother and bent down. Wrapping my arms around his thin waist, I lifted him up. But before I could pass him to Cad, he struggled against my grip, forcing me to replace him on the ground. "Wait, Vi!" he breathed. Tears moistened his eyes. "When am I going to see you again?" My voice caught in my throat. How could I answer a question like that? What could I tell him? I didn't want to lie and say that I would see him next week, next month, or even next year. Because once he reached the other side of the river, I didn't know if I would ever see him again. I cupped his face in my hands and planted a firm kiss against his forehead, his nose, then his cheeks. "We'll see," was all I could think to whisper. My chest ached as I thought of returning home to the orphanage tonight to sleep alone in my room, and tomorrow waking up without him. How I would have to maintain complete ignorance as to his whereabouts to everyone in the city. I pushed the thoughts aside. "I love you, Tim," I said, hugging him tightly as I buried my face in his hair. "Don't forget it." "I love you too, Ma," he whispered. "Ma." How I despised it when he called me that. And now, of all times. Gripping him firmly, I pried his arms away from my neck and rose to my feet. "You need to go," I choked. Tears streamed down his dirty cheeks as he finally let me pass him to Cad, who hauled him onto the boat. Even as Tim left my grasp, every part of me remained holding on. As Cad sat Tim down and, with a grim nod of his head, began to row away, I couldn't let go. My eyes stung as I gazed through the mist at their retreating shadows. I had already imagined this moment in my head long before tonight. I'd pictured myself standing on the muddy bank, staring out over the water, and waiting until the mist engulfed the boat, until I lost sight of them completely. But now that it was happening, I couldn't handle it. It only made Tim's departure seem all the more final, all the more conclusive. I turned and began wading back across the marshland, but after barely 5 steps, I stalled. 3 hunched shadows loomed near the wall. 3 large black dogs. Sniffers. And behind them, 2 tall, broad-shouldered women in deep green uniform. Wardens patrolling on their nightly rounds of the wall's perimeter. I dropped down, flattening myself against the wet ground, the panic in my chest almost suffocating me. It was too late. They had seen and sensed me. Growls ripped from the dogs' throats as they closed the distance. But it wasn't the end of the world if I was caught out here, as long as... "Watch out, Violet!" Tim's scream. My blood ran cold. "Stupid boy! Stupid, stupid boy!" The dogs' and warden's attention instantly shot to the water, where the outline of Cad's boat was still visible. Losing all interest in me, the 5 of them dashed to the water's edge. One of the women pulled out a whistle from her pocket and blew it before barking a command to the dogs. "No!" I cried, stumbling after them. In spite of its toxicity, the dogs leapt into the water, their powerful legs navigating the current twice as fast as Cad's oars as he attempted to speed up and escape. 2 of the animals reached the boat and leapt onto it, causing Cad to topple into the river. One of the dogs closed its jaws around Tim's shirt and tugged hard, pulling him over the edge and into the water. My vision became tunnel-like. All I could see was Tim being pulled through the water, back to the bank. I attempted to swoop in and grab him as the dog arrived at the shore, but one of the women leapt at me. Tripping up my already shaking legs, she tackled me to the ground.
"Violet!"
Tim screamed again. I gazed helplessly as the second warden locked his inflamed arms behind his back and began dragging him away. Back toward the wall. As the woman straddling my hips drove a tranquilizer dart into my shoulder, that scream would become the last memory I ever had of my brother. A marked boy. Chapter 1. 8 years later. Marymount Mill, read the sign hanging above the entrance of the Greystone Windmill. Facility for convicted juveniles. I wrinkled my nose, flexing my fingers around the handle of my tattered suitcase. I had no idea why it was called Marymount. There were no mounts around here, or anywhere in the flat land of Matris. Mountains were a luxury enjoyed only by our neighbors in Patris. And nothing about this towering brick building or the shriveled brown fields that surrounded it could be described as merry. But I ought to start getting used to it. This was to be my residence for the next 2 years, assuming I behaved myself. This would be my 3rd home, if a detention facility could be called that, in 5 years. A textiles factory deep in the countryside, about 20 miles from here, had been my first, and a sewage plant on the other side of the city, by Vail River, had been my 2nd. A flour mill certainly beat the latter. If I manage to keep myself in line here for the next 2 years and successfully complete my 7-year incarceration period, I would be on track for reintegration into the city a few days after my 21st birthday. Whatever life the court expected a girl with no family to live after having spent her adolescence locked away from society. And I had better not slip up. I'd already rebelled against the court at the age of 11 by committing obstruction of justice, and after being convicted of woman slaughter, albeit involuntary, via the use of a weapon, even if it was a dinner fork, a few years later. There would be only one fate left in store for me if I didn't get through these next 2 years without first-degree infractions. It would be straight to the city labs, where I would be put painlessly to sleep without further trial or consideration. There would be nobody to miss me, I supposed. I no longer had my younger brother. He'd been flagged as excessively domineering in the matriarchy's screening lab when he was 8, and consequently deemed an unfit member of Matrix's peaceful society. A score of 5 out of 5 for both aggressive tendencies and insubordination was essentially the kiss of death for any Matrix-born boy. Tim was a slave in the coal mines in the deep north now, or so I'd been told. I hadn't seen him since the day I'd failed to smuggle him to Patris. After I'd been caught and sedated by the riverside, I'd been forced to spend the next 2 weeks in isolation. My first taste of imprisonment. The more I begged to be sent to the mines with my brother, the more I was ignored. I even tried to locate the aircraft that transported the boys to the north once I got out, but I was caught near the hangar and thrust back into isolation with the stern warning that if I stepped out of line again, I would be locked up long term. Over the years, I'd eventually managed to see the futility in pursuing Tim. But the day I gave up looking for him was the beginning of a steeper downhill slide. A slide that I still struggled to find reason to fight against. And my anger simply fueled my rebellion. But I had to fight it now, and keep my head down, unless I truly did have a death wish. My aunt, uncle, and cousin Cad might miss me if I was gone, though I almost never saw them as they lived on the other side of the river in the patriarchy of Patris. Then there was the owner of my old orphanage, Ms. Connolly. She had always been kind to me, though she'd probably be senile by now, assuming she hadn't died already. The few childhood friends I'd had would have moved on with their lives. None of those friendships had been deep. "Keep moving, Ms. Bates," my escort said to me, nudging me in the shoulder. She was a green-uniformed warden armed with a crossbow, a stocky woman nameless to me and about 1/2 foot short of my height. The warden ushered me through the doorway, and we emerged in a small reception room whose walls were lined with lockers and hanging white aprons. An oval desk stood opposite the doorway, behind which sat a plump, middle-aged woman with cropped brown hair and horn-rimmed glasses. "Violet Bates," she said, glancing up, her lips, lined with plum-colored lipstick, pursed. She rose to her feet with a black registry book and wound around the table to approach us. She paused a few feet away, eyeing me shrewdly. 19 years old? I nodded curtly. "Almost a clean record for the past 4 years, she went on. 2 minor incidents of violence against fellow inmates involving punching. I nodded again, swallowing. Those punches had been well deserved. She furrowed her brows before concluding. "Right. I know where we have space for you. Follow me. My name's Ms. Maddox." Ms. Maddox led me through a back door, and we arrived in what I could only assume was the main place of work in this mill, a vast circular room filled with aisle upon aisle of grinding and sifting machinery. I sneezed. Everything in here was dusted with white particles. She led me across the room to a staircase, By the time we'd reached the top, my calves were burning, and Ms. Maddox was positively wheezing. I'd counted 8 floors in total. "You're right at the top," Ms. Maddox explained, panting as we turned into a dim, worn, gray-carpeted corridor lined with wooden doors. She stopped at the 6th door to my right and turned the handle. She pushed, but the door didn't budge. She huffed in frustration. "Josephine!" There was a span of silence before a vague voice replied, "Yeah?" "You have locked your door again. Were you not reprimanded just last week for this?" A bed creaked. Light footsteps sounded. A chair scraped, and the door slowly drew open. A waifish girl who looked no older than 9 stood barefoot in the doorway, wearing a checkered brown dress. Her face, splashed with freckles, was round and framed by a ginger mop of short, yet wildly curly hair. The apples of her cheeks were high and plump, her small lips pursed and heart-shaped. She had a look of righteous indignation in her large, almost bulbous green eyes. Her fingers flicked to the chair at her side. "It wasn't locked," she muttered, scowling. "Obstruction of entry to dormitories is forbidden," Ms. Maddox countered. "I do not want to have to remind you of that again." The girl rolled her eyes exaggeratedly and retreated into the room. Ms. Maddox led me inside. The windowless room was square-shaped and held very little, save for a bunk bed which Josephine had just climbed onto, the chair, a rickety table, and a chest of drawers. "Well, this is Josephine Rankin," Ms. Maddox explained. Josephine scrutinized me through the jungle of her low-cut bangs as she perched on the top bunk. "Hello," I said, offering her a small smile that she didn't return. "The bathrooms are situated to your right when you walk out the door at the end of the hallway," Ms. Maddox explained. "Meals are served at 8, 2, and 7:30. Work finishes at 7 p.m. each day. Lights out at 9:30 p.m. No exceptions. You should be asleep by 10 p.m. Wake-up call is 4 a.m. You have 30 minutes to get up, get washed, and be downstairs in the workroom." I grimaced. A wake-up call here was 1 hour earlier than even the sewage plant. "I trust that Josephine will answer any questions you may have," Ms. Maddox plowed on. "At 4:30 a.m. tomorrow, you'll be given a briefing of your tasks. It's 10 to 8 now, so you'll have to wait until tomorrow morning for food." My stomach was rumbling after the long journey to get here, but I was used to skipping meals. "You'll find that most of the same rules apply here as they did at Diveden Sewage, as well as at the textiles factory," Ms. Maddox continued. "Wardens roaming the building night and day, routine searches when entering and leaving the dining room, etc., etc." "Right," I muttered. I'd been searched before embarking on the journey to Marymount, too. Nothing sharp was allowed in my suitcase, not even nail clippers. That was why there were never mirrors in the dormitories of these facilities, only in the bathrooms, which were monitored by wardens. "I'll see you tomorrow morning," Ms. Maddox concluded. She backed out of the room and clicked the door shut behind her. I turned slowly to the bunk, resuming my focus on Josephine. I cleared my throat. "You sleep up there, I assume?" Josephine nodded. "Okay." I heaved a sigh before dumping my suitcase on the lower bunk. I sat down, spreading my palms over the mattress and gauging its softness. A little softer than my previous bed. Not that this was saying much. I removed my boots and rolled off my socks, stretching out my legs and toes. I sat there for a few minutes in silence, staring at the blank wall opposite me. Then I glanced at Josephine, who was still sitting in the same position, knees drawn up against her chest, arms around her shins. "Going to the restroom," I murmured, before leaving the room and taking a right turn down the corridor. The bathrooms were clearly marked at the end, and I moved inside to find a showering area and a row of sinks and cubicles. I stopped in front of one of the sinks to splash my face and caught my gray eyes in the mirror. I hadn't slept much last night, and it showed. I looked like crap. My skin, lightly tanned by the sun, appeared dry and lackluster, and my black shoulder-length hair, normally dead straight, was crimped and escaping in all directions from my ponytail. I shook it out, running my fingers through it, before heading to a stall to relieve myself. When I returned to the sinks, another girl had entered. A girl I recognized instantly. Her features were ratty, with thin lips, a protruding upper jaw, and lanky brown hair that clung to her scalp like a helmet. Vera Sykes. A girl who had almost caused me to gain a third infraction over the past 5 years due to a run-in I'd had with her back in the textiles factory. I had not seen her since. She looked just as surprised to see me, her eyes widening a fraction as she stared. But then she turned away abruptly, deciding to ignore me. She washed and dried her hands before sweeping toward the door. Though as she brushed past me, she moved a little too close, managing to nudge me in the back. Then she sped up, hastening through the exit. Idiot. I couldn't stand girls like Vera. Girls with neither brain nor backbone. Her way of surviving the facilities was by becoming the full-time ass-licker of whoever she deemed the toughest person in the block. Or the toughest person who could stand to be around her. She'd been friendly with me for a couple of days before I'd started avoiding her. After that, she'd gone behind my back and revealed her second face. Though, in fairness, I wasn't good at getting along with people my age in general. I struggled to connect and was often labeled a loner. Not that I minded. Making friends in facilities like this wasn't encouraged. It wasn't supposed to be a social club, and that was one of the reasons girls were uprooted and made to rotate the facilities. I returned to my room to find Josephine lying on her back, staring up at the ceiling. She didn't look at me as I entered, though she addressed me for the first time.
"What's your name?"
"Violet."
"And how did you wind up here?"
I sat down before turning my mind heavily back to that fateful day at school. It had been a sticky Monday afternoon. I'd been 14 years old when a girl 2 years my senior, whom I'd had a history of discord with, had picked a fight with me in the dining hall because I'd objected, in no timid words, to her jumping the line. We'd started with bare hands and would have continued that way if she hadn't scooped up a fork. I'd reciprocated to ward her off, not to plunge the fork into her throat. But she had launched at me at exactly the wrong moment and at exactly the wrong angle. She'd died in the hospital a few hours later. After that, my life became one of slavery to my country, waking up at the same time every day, being carted from one chore to the other, and trying to stay out of trouble. I'd gotten into a few fights, only two of them recorded. But I had been careful to avoid the use of actual weapons. Weapon usage by anyone other than an authorized warden was strictly prohibited throughout Matris. It was one of the most basic commandments of our monarch, Queen Rena. I didn't feel like spilling all this history to Josephine now, so I just replied, "I got into a fight with a bully. What about you? And how old are you, by the way?" I took a seat in the chair so that I could see her as we talked. She'd positioned her head closer to the edge of the bunk and was looking at me now.
"I'm 8 and a half. I'm only supposed to be here for another 2 weeks," she replied. "Mom was taken to the Drewsbury Center while I got stuck here. We got caught."
I frowned. "Caught?"
"Caught without permission, trying to return from Patris. We wanted badly to move back here. It's our home. I was born here, and so was Mom. But the court was telling us we'd have to wait 2 weeks for approval. We couldn't wait that long. Mom was going mad, and she was going to get into a lot of trouble if we didn't leave Patris right away. So she traveled back with me in my uncle's rowboat. We left Dad. It was disturbing that Josephine should be put in a facility like this one, which was filled with girls convicted of far worse crimes than premature migration. Her crime had not even been hers, but her mother's. But this was common of the court's decisions. They were known to make statements, however harsh, to discourage the public from even considering infractions. Matrix's government frowned upon residents who decided to move to the patriarchy in the first place, so making it difficult for them to return ensured that they thought long and hard about their choice. "How come you went to Patrix to begin with?" I asked, although I hardly needed to. There weren't a lot of reasons that women who were born and bred in Matrix would migrate to Patrix.
"Because of my dad," Josephine responded grimly. "He was born there. He moved to Matrix because my mom asked him to. They married here and he took her name. But he couldn't survive here. He begged Mom to let him take us back with him."
"And your mom couldn't bear it in Patrix," I finished. Just as marriages only usually lasted in Matrix, if Matrix was all the man had ever known, the same was true of marriages in Patrix. Women born there were conditioned to the ways of life in the patriarchy. They didn't suffer from culture shock as Matrix-born women did. A woman in Patrix had about as much rights as a pet animal. She couldn't legally reside there without being owned by a man. And even with a husband, she was limited. She couldn't go out by herself. She couldn't work, drive, or own money or property. I'd even heard that their physical appearance and clothes were dictated by the man, if he so chose. And arguing was completely taboo. Women were dependent to a humiliating degree. I'd spent the last 5 years of my life as a Matrian prisoner, but even so, I was sure that I still held more dignity than I would in a patriarchy. I had never crossed the river to Patrix, as I suspected no self-respecting Patrian man would want to cross to Matrix either, unless it was on business. Things weren't a lot easier for men here. Any Patrian male wishing to migrate to Matrix had to first undergo a full background check to shed light on any potential disruptive tendencies. Only if the man was deemed to be a low to moderate risk, it was rare for any Patrian male to be considered a low risk, would he be allowed to be coupled with a Matrian woman and adopt her last name. Retaining his ego was out of the question. No matter what qualifications he might have arrived with, he would be relegated to an occupation of repetitive manual labor. Only sons of the court were allowed to pursue the sciences or other intellectual professions. They weren't allowed to own property or assets, although they were allowed to drive and roam by themselves. This extra leniency shown toward them was made up for by the harshness of Matrius's legal system. There was little male-committed crime in Matrix for a reason. Such differing upbringings between Patrian-Matrian couples were all but impossible to reconcile in the long term. Vale River was known colloquially as Suicide Stretch, and there had been more than a few incidents of couple suicides over the years. Hookups between the nations usually only happened if one of them had an occupation that required them to spend time on the other side of the river, like trade officials or negotiations ambassadors. The majority of women in Matrix either chose a Matrian partner or opted to be without a partner completely and conceive in an insemination center. My mother had chosen the latter to have my brother and me, and if I ever decided I wanted a child, I would do the same. I didn't need a man in my life, not even a Matrian male. And from all that I'd been told by my mother before she died, I was better off without one anyway. Better to remain always self-reliant. Self-reliance means you're in control. Don't ever think you need a man for happiness. Besides, even Matrian husbands were a headache with all the accompanying paperwork and responsibility they came with. These days, I had a hard enough time being responsible for myself. Josephine shuddered, horror swimming in her irises.
You don't know how bad it is in Patrix for us girls, Violet.
From the few papers I'd managed to get a glimpse of in the communal areas of my last facility, the situation wasn't about to get any better. The newly ascended King Maxon was proving himself to be a more ruthless monarch than his recently deceased father. He was rumored to be pouring a staggering amount of resources into the development of a new pharmaceutical drug that anesthetized emotions while sharpening logic and intellect. Hardly the makings of an empathetic people. Reporters feared this would make Matris's dealings with the nation only more strained in the years to come. Patris's emphasis on drug development worried them especially, as Matris's thus far unrivaled expertise in the fields of biology and medicine was the one thing Matris truly had to offer Patris in exchange for water and fresh crops from the verdant mountainous region. Matris could survive without Patris's trade, but it would make life more austere for all of us. Things hadn't always been this way. According to our history books, centuries ago, Matris and Patris didn't even exist. There were one group of people, one band of survivors of the last war that toxified vast swaths of the great land once known as America. The troop discovered a small haven amid the wasteland of Appalachia, a haven that was the stretch of mountainous land now occupied by Patris. All the survivors used to live on that side of the river, men and women. It was only after they began the work of building a new civilization that political divide struck. It started with a party of women protesting against the colony's quickly forming male-dominated leadership. The party believed that if men were allowed to prevail again, they were simply creating a replica of the former testosterone-driven regime that had led everything to ruin. They argued that if they were to learn anything from the past and stand a chance of building a better future, women must finally take the reins. But the men in power refused. No satisfactory headway was made after countless meetings and protests. Thus, the female party had a choice. Stay and essentially bite their tongues, or leave and put their beliefs into practice elsewhere. They opted for the latter after discovering that the land on the other side of the river, while not as conducive for living as their current side, was still habitable compared to everywhere else they had searched. And so began the split. It wasn't only women who chose to follow the female party in founding Matris. A percentage of men agreed with their manifesto and followed them too. Similarly, a portion of women chose to remain under male rule. The most outspoken of the female party was put forward to lead Matris as queen. Queen Daphne the First, and soon after, the first king was appointed in Patris, whose name slipped my mind. To say that both nations had come a long way since their founding must be an understatement. We had so many structures and amenities and rules and restrictions in place now, not to mention the increase in population, that I found it hard to imagine what it must have been like in those pioneering days, hundreds of years ago. Certainly there hadn't been as many rules so early on. Though, if I remembered my history correctly, the screening of violent boys was instituted by Matris's politicians pretty quickly, as well as the building of aircraft that were used to discover the mines in the deep north. Josephine was quiet. Her expression had turned somber, distant. I left the chair and sank into bed, where I began rifling in my suitcase for my night clothes. "Do you have any brothers or sisters?" she asked. An innocent change of subject. My throat tightened. "No," I lied.
"Me neither," Josephine murmured.
I was glad that she didn't say anything more than that. After changing into my pajamas, I rummaged in the side pocket of my suitcase until my fingers ran over a thin, smooth square and my mini flashlight. I dimmed the ceiling light before crawling beneath my blanket. I switched on the flashlight, illuminating the most precious item I possessed, a faded photograph of a boy with eyes and hair like mine. My brother, at 5 years old, 3 years before he'd failed the screening. It was a picture of him on a swing, a broad grin splitting his chubby, mud-smeared face, a snapshot from a time when our life was happier. The photo had a bit of tape still attached to the back from where I had fixed it against my bedpost in my previous room. I stuck it against the wall now, level with my pillow, and stared at it long into the night, far past 10 o'clock. I replayed the months, weeks, and days before his capture over in my mind, and wondered if there was anything I could have done differently. I didn't think so. My brother was what he was, a fault in Matrix's system. Surrounded by Josephine's snores, I switched off the flashlight. Chapter 2. I felt like death when a blaring alarm sounded the next morning at exactly 4 a.m. I'd have to face the consequences of falling asleep so late for the rest of the day. Josephine leapt out of bed and I clambered groggily after her. Gathering up our clothing, we moved to the showers, which, thankfully, were separated into stalls. After washing and dressing, Josephine and I followed the crowd milling down the hallway, heading for the staircase. I spotted Vera up front, standing next to the largest girl among us. The girl's hair was so short and her build so wide, one could have easily mistaken her for a man from behind. I kept my eyes down, avoiding people's gazes, as we piled down the long staircase. On reaching the ground floor, we entered the workroom and lined up in front of the machinery. At 4:30 a.m. on the dot, Ms. Maddox entered the room, holding her black registry book. One by one, she called out and ticked off our names. Facility registers were usually in chronological order, rather than alphabetical, which meant that the girl who had been called out before me, the troll of a girl I'd spotted earlier, Dina Bradbury, must have arrived just shortly before me. "All right," Ms. Maddox said, snapping her book shut. "Work begins." Everyone began moving to the machinery, while Ms. Maddox approached me and explained my responsibilities. I understood and quickly got the hang of the grinding machine she was asking me to monitor. It wasn't a difficult task. The hours blurred into one another, as I was used to them doing, and I stopped looking up at the clock. Finally, it was time for breakfast. We exited the mill and trudged along a pebble path toward a bleak brick building a quarter of a mile away, which served as the dining hall. A buffet was already laid out. I'd lost sight of Josephine in the crowd, so I lined up with the rest of them and piled my plate with hot food. We were only allowed one plate per meal, so everyone filled it to spilling point. I was still looking for Josephine when I turned to search for somewhere quiet to sit. Then I caught a glimpse of her fiery red hair on the opposite side of the room. She stood with her back against the wall, while Dina loomed in front of her. I couldn't spot any wardens around. Perhaps they were outside the door, waiting until the crowd in here settled down. Forgetting all about finding a quiet spot, I dumped my plate and cutlery down on the nearest table to me and weaved through the crowd toward them. My eyes trained on Josephine as she picked up one of her bread rolls and handed it to Dina. Before she could do the same with her second roll, I stepped between the girls and gripped Josephine's arm, guiding the roll back to its rightful place on her plate. My gaze was steely as I glared at Dina. Although we were actually almost the same height and roughly the same age, physically, she was much larger than me. This was the first time I'd seen her face up close. Her eyes were small and spread too far apart to be attractive, their color dark brown, almost black. Her forehead hung low, and metal braces glinted against her teeth. "Who are you?" she asked, her eyes narrowing. "I'd like to ask the same," I replied calmly. My eyes fell to the roll on her plate that belonged to Josephine. Before she could react, I snatched it up and returned it. Clutching the young girl's shoulder,
I pulled her out of the corner Dina had bullied her into and stood in her place.
I suggest you keep to what's yours, I whispered.
Dina's broad cheeks flushed and a muscle in her jaw twitched. Anger glinted in her eyes. Her disposable plate creaked in the tightening grip of her meaty hands. But then she backed down, as I'd known she would, and turned on her heel and steamed away. I knew a coward when I saw one. Dozens of eyes were on me as I escorted Josephine to the table where I'd left my plate and cutlery. Nobody had touched it. I pulled up a chair for Josephine next to me, and we both sat down.
You make sure you stay away from that girl, okay?
I told Josephine as I dug into my porridge. The girl looked shaken as she picked up a piece of apple. She glanced nervously at Dina, who, having taken a seat across the room from us, next to her new crony Vera, was glaring daggers our way.
And don't look at her, I said. Giving her attention makes her think she has power over you. Ignore her.
Josephine resumed her focus on her plate. She took a bite of everything but the two rolls, which were the most substantial food she'd collected. So I gave her my untouched sandwich.
Eat this. It hasn't been contaminated by piggy hands.
That brought a smile to Josephine's face.
Thanks,
she mumbled. She accepted and began munching. We spent the next 15 minutes in mostly silence as we finished eating, and then a bell warned us that breakfast was drawing to a close. We had to get a move on. Josephine and I picked up our plates and left the table to get in the line leading up to the trash cans. After I dumped my plate in the waste, someone brushed into my right side. I turned to see it was Vera. She had a comically solemn look on her face as she leaned back against the wall and crossed her arms over her chest.
Mind where you're going, I muttered, before taking Josephine's hand and leading her away.
You really shouldn't mess with Dina, you know, Vera called after me.
I didn't give Vera the satisfaction of turning around and asking why, but she offered it herself.
I'm serious, Violet Bates. I share a room with her. You don't know where she's come from.
Oh, please. I sped up with Josephine and exited the dining hall, Vera's irritating voice fading out in the crowd. I asked Ms. Maddox if Josephine and I could share a workstation after lunch, and she agreed. She allowed us to choose one in the far end of the room, as far from the other girls as we could be. After an hour or so, Josephine seemed to put thoughts of the incident with Dina behind her and became chatty. She asked me more questions about myself. Particularly, she was interested in my parents. I told her that I didn't know who my father was and that my mother had chosen to conceive my brother and me in the city's insemination center. She had died from complications during my brother's birth.
So you do have a brother? Josephine asked.
Not anymore.
What happened to him?
I hesitated before replying.
He failed the test. Oh, I'm sorry, Josephine said, subdued.
She understood that there was only one kind of test that a boy could fail in Matrix, and it had nothing to do with education. Other than the basic ability to read and add up numbers, boys weren't given an education like girls were, just an apprenticeship in manual labor. The same was true of the girls in Patras who weren't allowed to attend school like the boys. The only semblance of training they received was domestic. I was grateful when Josephine redirected the conversation. Talking about Tim was painful. She asked what my favorite subject at school was, and I immediately thought of my defense training. My lessons with Ms. Dale had been the highlights of my week. Ever since I could remember, my dream had been to become a warden when I grew up. There was something about their toughness, their strength, that I had always admired. I had never pictured myself pursuing any other occupation. That had lasted up until the age of 11, when Tim had been captured. A lot of things had changed in me after that. I'd found myself getting into fights easily and had visited the doctor for medication to ease my bouts of anger. Once Tim had gone, all of the attraction becoming a warden had previously held for me evaporated. After my brief spell of imprisonment for trying to smuggle a marked boy to Patris, I'd still continued my defense training because, well, it was the only thing I really knew how to do well. And Ms. Dale had encouraged me to continue. She'd told me I had a natural instinct for fighting, and that it would be a shame to let it go to waste. Maybe when I got older, I'd changed my mind. I didn't think so, but I followed her advice. Although it had been a long time now since I'd had any formal training, my instinct had never really left me. And over the years of incessant manual labor, my body had kept fit and strong. Plus, I'd grown in height.
"I wish I could be brave and tough like you." Josephine sighed wistfully as she dipped her hands into a trough of flour.
"You can be," I told her. "It's all about your mindset. Refuse to be browbeaten. Like this morning. You didn't have to hand over your bread rolls. You could have refused, pushed past her, and gone outside to look for a warden."
Josephine nodded. "I suppose I could have," she mumbled.
I took my turn in asking her questions. Her own favorite subjects, her dreams and aspirations. She told me she wanted to be an environmentalist like her mother. She wanted to help improve the soil in Matris so that we could produce more natural foods and import less from Patris. A noble career. I wished I had such a strong vision for my future once I got out of here. I still had 2 years ahead of me. But Josephine's focus made me feel I ought to start thinking more seriously about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. By the time it was time to stop work, I had developed a thorough liking for the young redhead. Perhaps it was just her age, but she reminded me of my brother. Not the timid and shy side of her, but the fiery, feisty side that bubbled to the surface on occasion. I hoped she wouldn't lose that as she got older. If she received the right training and diet, she'd make a good fighter. Unlike my brother, she wouldn't be penalized for her boldness. Unless she started doing stupid things like brandishing dinner forks in a fight. We hung up our aprons in the reception room and headed back to our room, where I picked up my night clothes before heading out again to take a shower. My hair badly needed a wash, and I was feeling dusty in the most unexpected of places from having spent the day in the mill. I stood for a while in the shower, relishing the warm water gushing down my back. Showers, like rain, always had a way of calming me. The pitter-patter beat, the incessant contact. Nothing made me feel sleepy faster. But my shower turned lukewarm too soon, an unpleasant quirk of detention facility bathrooms. Wardens didn't want girls dawdling. They never wanted girls dawdling. I hurried to finish washing my hair before it could go ice cold. Then I dried, dressed, and left the bathrooms. My eyes were beginning to droop as I returned to our door, and I wanted nothing more now than to climb into bed and lose myself in sleep, even if it did mean skipping dinner. But my pleasant daze was disturbed as I arrived to find our door ajar. That was unlike Josephine, and I was sure that I'd left it closed. When I pushed the door open, I saw Josephine trembling on the floor, her right eye bruised and puffy. Surrounding her were the contents of my suitcase, scattered all over the room. My gaze shot to my most prized possession. Tim's photograph had disappeared from my wall, and on my pillow lay a pile of shreds, the only relic I had left of my lost brother, destroyed. "Dina?" was all I managed to breathe. Josephine whimpered a, "Yes?" That photograph had survived with me through a lot of shifts and upheavals. The thought that it should be ripped from me like this, by that animal. I wanted to both scream and cry at once, but instead I surrendered to an emotion I had gotten to know all too well, and felt all too often over the past 8 years. Anger.
My fury consumed me, and every fiber of my being felt like it was burning up. I couldn't even bring myself to care if what I was about to do would prolong my sentence by months. Feeling my fists connecting with that monster's face would make it all worthwhile. My chest heaving as I attempted to regain some semblance of control, I thundered out of the room. That girl is going to regret ever crossing paths with me. Chapter 3. I stopped the first girl I came across in the hallway, a rotund 15 or 16-year-old, and gripped her shoulders. "Which room is Dina Bradbury's?" I demanded of her in a menacing whisper.
"I don't know," she stammered, trying to shrug away.
Cursing beneath my breath, I let her go before moving on to the next girl, and then the next. The fourth girl I stopped knew which room Dina resided in, and the moment the answer left her lips, I hurtled there. Arriving outside the door, I burst in, my fists balled so tight my short nails dented my flesh. Dina was standing on the opposite side of the room with her back toward me. I couldn't see what she was doing exactly, but as she twisted around, her eyes bulged. I had found her alone, with nobody to obstruct my path to her. I lunged forward and grabbed hold of her shirt. Swinging a leg behind her knees, I sent her crashing to the floor. I leaped on top of her, pinning her down. Then I began pummeling blow after heavy blow against her face. She groaned, her large form struggling beneath me as I straddled her hips. Her head shifted from side to side, trying to avoid my beating. Then she raised a hand and managed to catch the next punch before it could connect. Her grip closed around my fist, and I fought to maintain my dominance as she twisted forcefully beneath me. She managed to dislodge me with a speed I hadn't been expecting, getting me on my side. She thrust her knee upward to collide with my groin, but I shielded myself with my shins. We broke apart, scrambling to our feet. Her nose was already bleeding. Next, I would squash it, flat. I was about to close in on her again when, to my confusion, she reached into her mouth. When she withdrew her hand, she was holding the top and bottom layers of her braces. Removable braces. She'd managed to keep them from the wardens. My pulse raced as I realized what she was doing. She quickly broke off the smooth rubber seal at the end of each of the wires, leaving them bare and pointed. Then she held a brace in each hand, positioning the wiry ends between her fingers so they stuck out like claws. As she lashed out with her right arm, I swiped it with mine, knocking it away from me. "She has weapons. I can't get caught up in this. I need to get out of here," my brain was telling me. And yet my mind and emotions were dictating a different thing entirely. I hadn't hurt her enough yet. I wanted to break her nose, give her a black eye, split her cheekbone. I wanted to give her some kind of permanent scar so that she would always have something to remind her of what she had done to me. She swung out at me again, this time with both hands. I ducked, but not fast enough. She managed to catch my right shoulder, splitting the fabric of my shirt and etching a stinging cut into my skin. And then she launched all her weight toward me at once, crushing me against the floor as I had done to her. She raised both hands and attempted to bring them down against me, wires pointed downward. I gripped her wrists, stopping them a few inches away from my body, using every muscle in my arms and shoulders to keep the wires from plunging into me. Catching the glint of malice in her eyes came as a wake-up call. I realized in this moment she was as crazy as I was. Neither of us are thinking straight. Even though my rage was still running wild, this was just stupid. Really stupid. So she ripped up Tim's picture. I can try to piece it back together again, but I can't get involved in this. What the hell am I doing? As I strained beneath her weight, I struggled to slip out of the lock she had me in. I had made my bed, and now I was forced to lie in it. If I'd had longer nails, I could have dug them into her flesh in an attempt to loosen her grip.
Instead, I had only my bony fingertips to use to press down hard against her pressure points. I managed to make her left hand release its hold on the brace, but with the right hand now free, she used it to clamp around my neck, crushing my windpipe. As I gazed into her dark eyes and fought to breathe, I wondered if she would actually go so far as to kill me. Maybe Vera had been